We'll move into this next session. As Lachlan was saying, my name's Ron Duncan, here from the Development Policy Centre at Crawford. And so we're going to have three discussions, somewhat different. Sini is going to be talking about the future of Pacific regionalism. Matt Dornan will be talking about pooled service delivery in the Pacific, and Bob Warner, lessons in regional integration from the Caribbean. So Sini will be our first speaker, and she's currently managing a comprehensive review of the Pacific Plan as part of her role as the Pacific Plan Advisor at the Forum Secretariat in Suva. Thank you, Sini.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to start off just with a couple of short apologies. Firstly, from our Deputy Secretary General, Felitti Teo, who was invited to talk at this conference today and unfortunately is tied up with other meetings in Suva, so he passes on his apologies. And secondly, I have a brief apology to those of you who I know were in the audience a couple of days ago where I presented a few of these same slides talking about the Pacific Plan review. But I hope you'll be heartened to know that there are a couple of points of difference today. A key one being that we actually have a member of the Pacific Plan review team in our midst, Ms. Noumea Simi, who's at the back there. So I hope if there are any thorny questions about the review, Noumea will be there to help me out or to pull me up if I get anything wrong. As for the introduction, I'm from the Forum Secretariat, and we've been given the role of managing and assisting with the Pacific Plan review, but it is an independent process. And so what I'd like to do today is just highlight some of the findings that the team has released and made public thus far, noting that we'll hear more from them in about a month's time when they put out their draft report, which will have a lot more details about some of the initial proposals. I should also point out that this topic of the future of Pacific regionalism was one that we were given by the ANU to talk to, and it does seem a rather lofty topic, but I think actually the Pacific Plan review is a really good lens through which to look towards the future of Pacific regionalism whilst also looking a little bit at the past. So to begin, I don't want to go very far into the past because, in fact, the Pacific Plan itself is a relatively young document, and again, I have shown this before, and people should be very familiar with this leader's vision, which was issued in 2004. It feels perhaps a little back to the future, because at that time, they were talking very much about this future vision for the region, which I think is held solid over the intervening years. It was really supposed to be the foundation on which the Pacific Plan was based. So the year following, the Pacific Plan was put together and endorsed by leaders. It was based at the time on some studies that were actually done by the Asian Development Bank and the Commonwealth, which looked into options for pooling service provision and various forms of regionalism. And when it first came out, it was perhaps a little unwieldy document. It had about 44 initiatives that were listed in its annexes as areas of regional cooperation and integration that could be pursued by Pacific Island countries. Over the subsequent years, those initiatives or priorities were updated on a regular basis until we got to about 2009, and a medium-term set of priorities were identified. But as you'll see, they weren't trimmed very much. We got to 37, and those are still the priorities that are in place in the Pacific Plan. And this is one of the issues that will be or is being addressed in the current review is, you know, really what are our priorities as a region, and in particular, how can we focus on priorities for regional cooperation and integration. So to give you a sense of perhaps what's different about this review from past reviews, and I know that we also have in our midst people who have a lot of experience in the region and have seen a number of reviews being undertaken, perhaps not only on the Pacific Plan, but on the entire regional architecture for the Pacific and reviews of the Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat. And one thing that we think is a point of difference with this review, we hope, is that it's led by an eminent person from the region, Sir McCary, and he has a very strong team with him. We have two country officials who've been there in support and two international consultants who have actually been brought on to help in producing the review's outputs as well. And this team has been given a very large task. They've been asked not only to look at the Pacific Plan as a document, but actually to think more broadly about the context in which the Pacific Plan is situated. And as has been alluded to in the previous session, that context has really changed. Even over the short few years since the Pacific Plan was first implemented, we've seen the rise of sub-regionalism. We've seen the change in the international agenda and a number of agreements that the Pacific has signed up to or issues on which a shared stance has been taken. And there's been pressure on the Pacific Plan to really take that role of helping to present a shared platform for the Pacific. And at the same time, there's been pressure from the national level to align with a lot of national development plans and show how that these objectives that are outlined in the at a regional level also relate to community and national levels. So the team has been really asked to look at that whole broad context and really think about governance issues as well as the wording of the plan itself. They've been rather busy in the few months that they've been on the job. From January to May this year, they travelled around all of our foreign member countries and our two associate members, so 18 countries in total. And throughout those consultations, they were meeting with politicians. They were actually here at ANU a couple of months ago and held a consultation with academics. They've been meeting with other regional organisations. They've been meeting with civil society groups, so really trying to canvass a whole range of voices. Of course, they haven't been able to speak with everyone, and they've tried to hear a little more by inviting public submissions. And I know that in the end we've received over 70, and although that public submissions process is now officially closed, they've generously said that if there are some more pressing issues that people want to convey to them, that they'll hear those. And in particular, if there are issues that are responding to the documents, the review notes that the team has already put out. As I mentioned earlier, the team is due to come back to us at the end of next month and certainly in time for the Pacific Plan Action Committee meeting in early August with their draft report, which we think will provide some more detail on their interim findings, which I'd like to touch on now. One of the key findings that the team have presented was in the presentation at, which was given in Suva at the end of May, was really focusing on the region that they found during their consultations. And a lot of this isn't new material, but it's really important to hear and to reflect back because it was really what was amalgamated from all the stories and the voices that they heard. So, of course, there was a recognition of the diversity of the region, of connections between people at the same time as fragmentation. But what I really like to focus on here was the sense that there was an ongoing appetite for regionalism that did come through from all the consultations. But also there was a diversity of opinion on what regionalism meant and really if it was a journey that we're on and it was a long-term journey, where exactly that journey was going to. The team talked a little bit about a spectrum of regional cooperation through to integration and emphasised that the Pacific region is very much at the cooperation end of that spectrum at this stage. And they felt that the current Pacific Plan really wasn't the document that we needed to take us forward into that next stage. We need some changes. They proposed that, and again we'll see more details on this soon, but that what we needed was a new Pacific framework, something that shouldn't be seen as a really comprehensive regional development plan that was all about an integrated region, and also something that shouldn't be all about listing priorities for donors to come in and fund, but should be much more capturing the essence of what countries were really keen to work on, perhaps at the level more of pooling and cooperation than at the heavily integrated level. They also talked a lot about creating a space for political dialogue on these issues and the importance of actually giving leaders that opportunity to sit and discuss and create a collegial atmosphere in which they could identify the areas in which they really saw the most promise in working together and were then open to all the suggestions that were put up to them for the most viable economic and political options. I think it might be good to note there too that there would need to be some changes in the existing regional architecture that we have in order to make this happen. And the team did make some suggestions in that regard. They talked about the need for some gatekeeping on the kinds of issues that were put forward for leaders' consideration. As I mentioned earlier, at present we've got 37 priorities on the table. It's really too many. We need to think about how to trim that down and do that in a sensitive way. And at the same time, not completely cut the fundamentals out of the Pacific Plan. And some of those are things like the real values that the Pacific region wants to have expressed in this document. So I think they have a rather challenging task ahead of them in proposing what this future plan will look like, something that still captures the values but also is a lot more streamlined and is really going to give us a clear vision of what we need going forward. Thank you. So just to come back to the timeline for all of this, we'll see in September the ending of this current review process when Sir Macquarie is going to meet with the region's leaders at their meeting in Marshall Islands. But that certainly won't be the end of this journey. We hope that what the team will give us at that stage will be a lot of food for thought going forwards, but we will need a lot of engagement from, of course, from leaders and officials, but from a lot of different stakeholders in the region to help map out those next steps. I think when leaders asked the team to go out and perform this review, they called for a refreshed Pacific plan to be brought back to them. But I think what's been made clear is that we can't just sit a team of even very talented consultants and officials and a leader out and ask them to come back with a whole new plan for the Pacific. That plan actually has to be something that comes through from all of the member countries. So what we're hoping is that they'll give us the document that will set out some next steps, but certainly won't be the end of the process. I'd just like to end by giving you the URL for the team's website. I think it's important to have a look at that because they've been putting up all their documents as they go along, and it's been a wonderfully transparent process. We've had all the submissions have been loaded up there as well as their review notes. I think up to this stage their full presentation that they gave in May is up there, and we expect that there'll be a few more review notes over the coming weeks before they present their final report. So we hope that everyone will make the most of that opportunity to see the documents and will be engaged. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Sini. Next is Matt Dornan, and Matt's going to talk about pooled service delivery in the Pacific. Matt's a research fellow here in the Development Policy Centre, and his work is doing research on aid and economic development. Thanks, Matt.
Well, good afternoon, and welcome, everyone. I think I've been in contact with most of our overseas visitors, so it's great to have you here. Today I want to present interim findings from a study of regional or pooled service delivery in the Pacific. This is work that I've done jointly with Tess Newton-Kane, with guidance from Stephen Howes, and with the support of the Asia and the Pacific Policy Studies Journal. The pool provision of services is one of three forms of regionalism identified in the Pacific Plan. The other two are regional coordination, involving trade and possibly labour migration, and regional cooperation, involving harmonisation and coordination of policies. Pooling It's promoted on many grounds, but I think the key one is achieving economies of scale. Now, pooling received considerable support at the time the Pacific Plan was drafted. I completely agree with Wesley's point that support for regionalism has come and gone in the Pacific at various times. So at the time the Pacific Plan was drafted, there was great support for regionalism, and I think that has waned somewhat in recent years. The Pacific Plan proposed pooling in bulk fuel procurement, aviation, shipping for small island states, and vocational education. And it also sought analysis of potential for pooling in five other areas. The Asian Development Bank and Commonwealth Secretariat produced a study in 2005 towards a new Pacific regionalism, which provided cost-benefit analysis for various pooling initiatives. Surprisingly, though, since 2005, there's been no study of whether pooling initiatives thought promising then have actually been established, and if so, how they have performed. And that's what we are seeking to address through this ongoing study. Regional pooling is difficult, and this is highlighted by club theory. The voluntary nature of pooling means that each member needs net positive benefits in order to join and to remain in a club. That alone isn't enough, though. Benefits from pooling must also be higher than those associated with national service delivery. These sovereignty benefits, as they're often referred to as, include donor funding for national service delivery and employment that is associated with. And the MIRA model tells us that these benefits can be very significant, particularly for small and micro states. Benefits also need to be high enough to offset other short-term adjustment costs, such as the cost of harmonising policy settings, which is often a precondition for pooled service delivery. And lastly, benefits need to be shared fairly in order that countries don't enter into conflict and withdraw from a pooling initiative. The Pacific Plan promotes pooling where the market and where national and local level governments are not already providing a service adequately. And this is something that Rob Tranter from AusAid presented on Tuesday night, the market and subsidiarity tests. Another question is also relevant, though, and that is, will regional organisations deliver a service effectively? The mixed performance of international organisations around the world suggests that I think this is a question that is worth asking. And Tony Hughes, in his 2005 review of the regional architecture, identified management capture as a problem for Pacific regional organisations. Now, management capture is essentially a form of principal-agent problem, where a principal, being Pacific Island governments, delegate a task to an agent, the regional organisation. But because we don't live in a world of perfect information, that can lead to a situation where the agent may pursue its own objectives at the expense of the principal. Now, there are reasons for thinking that international and regional organisations are especially susceptible to principal-agent problems. Focus on public administration means that it's difficult to measure their performance, at least in comparison with many private sector entities. Regional organisations also have multiple principals, the states that form their membership, and those states have competing priorities. And this weakens their power relative to regional organisations. In this slide, I've tried to capture some of that complexity in terms of the principal-agent problem. So far, I've highlighted the challenges presented by pooling. I now want to spend the rest of the presentation discussing our findings to date. So we've looked at over 20 initiatives in the Pacific as part of this study, five of them in some detail. And from that analysis, I want to highlight five key points. So since 2005, the number of attempts to pool services has grown. There have been seven attempts since the year 2005. I think this is actually in some ways a vindication of the Pacific Plan, which was established, we have to remember, in order to facilitate regionalism. It was never established as a development plan, despite being treated as such. It's true, many attempts to pool services haven't been successful, but this in itself isn't a failure. If analysis has been undertaken and a decision made that a pooling initiative isn't feasible, possibly because the costs outweigh the benefits, then that really should be regarded as a success of public policy. I think several initiatives fit this description in the Pacific, not completely, but partially. Bulk procurement of fuel and bulk procurement of pharmaceuticals comes to mind. The second point, a patchwork of pooled service provision has emerged. So clubs that pool services in the Pacific have different membership bases. Almost no pooled services are the same. And I've got some examples there for you. Again, I think this is a real strength of regionalism in the Pacific. A patchwork of pooled service provision can be more cost-effective as Pacific Island governments are able to pick and choose which clubs they are actually a member of. Different clubs can also complement one another, and I think this is shown historically by the relationship between the parties to the Nauru Agreement and the Foreign Fisheries Agency. Sorry, I'm going quickly through these slides as I don't have much time. Pooled service delivery involves a centralisation of resources, which can benefit some countries disproportionately, and I think this is inevitable. Efforts to distribute benefits are evident in the location of organisations, so it would be more efficient to have all regional organisations in one place, Suva. What do we have, though? Yes, many are in Suva, but we also have regional organisations based around the Pacific, in Honiara, Apia, Majuro. tension between commercial and equity objectives is also evident in the operation of regional organisations. So Pacific Forum Line, for example, decided to focus on commercial routes at the expense of unprofitable services to smaller island members. And at USP, which is the great success of regionalism, there's also this ongoing tension between investment in Laudala campus and investment in other regional campuses and centres. Now, almost all pooled services in the Pacific rely on donor funds, and this is a point of difference with club theory, which was used in that ADB ComSec study, and it's also a difference with pooling in many other regions of the world. The initiatives that we looked at received on average 80% of their funding from donor, but there's enormous variation within that figure. Now, donor funding has both positive and negative benefits. On the positive side, donor funding has made pooled service provision financially viable and sustainable. Donor assistance, however well-intentioned though, also has negative impacts, and I think these are inevitable in many ways. So donor funds act as a price distortion, paying for schemes that aren't necessarily valued by Pacific Island members. Donor funds also inevitably affect the incentives of regional organisations, which pursue and sometimes compete for that donor funding, and are also under less pressure from member countries to perform, both because they don't need funding from member countries, but also because member countries are less likely to exert pressure on them, given that the regional organisations, are seen as a free resource. And this last argument has parallels with the governance literature, which highlights the importance of taxation for ensuring that citizens keep governments accountable. The other distinct feature of initiatives that we've looked at is that many are actually about pooling of capacity-building efforts rather than service delivery. Where pooled services are delivered, this happens alongside and is often marginal to capacity-building efforts. This is partly because they're donor-funded, but I think it also reflects the priorities of Pacific Island governments, and that is a good thing. At the same time, a focus on building national capacity to some extent contradicts the purpose of pooling, which is to deliver services at the regional level. And I think there are a number of explanations for both the emphasis on capacity building and reluctance among Pacific Island governments to fund pooled services. These include political economy issues. Individual ministries can be reluctant to cede power and budget resources. There are legitimate concerns about sovereignty, given the recent colonial history of many countries in the region. There are sovereignty benefits associated with national service provision. These are especially important among smaller states. And lastly, I think there's considerable uncertainty about the benefits of regional service delivery. Concluding paragraph, these factors on balance make me pessimistic on the whole about the prospects for expanding pooled service provision, at least along the lines envisaged in the Pacific Plan. I think that cooperation will continue to be the dominant form of Pacific regionalism. That said, pooling does and it will continue to occur. There have been some success stories, both where Pacific Island governments have used services provided by a metropolitan power, say central banking, but also at the sub-regional level. And I think this sub-regional focus is a very good thing. I think it reflects the diverse nature of countries in the region in terms of their size, levels of development, cultural background, the list goes on. And these differences, I think, make very challenging the delivery of services at that Pacific-wide regional level. I'll finish there. Thank you.
And lastly, we have Bob Warner, who's going to talk on lessons about regional integration from the Caribbean. And Bob is the Director of Pacific Research Partnerships here at the Crawford School. Bob was previously with the Centre for International Economics and prior to that worked at the World Bank and the Productivity Commission. Thank you, Bob.
Good afternoon. This afternoon I'm going to try and take you on a cruise around Caribbean integration. But unfortunately, since I've only got 10 minutes, it's going to be a cruise in a speedboat rather than a luxury liner. So in case things get a bit bumpy or you miss some of the sights, what I'd like to do is also to point out, as Christopher did, this morning that in the Pacific Economic Monitor, this recent issue, there's a slightly less sketchy treatment of the issues that might give you a bit more background on what's been happening in the Caribbean and also give you a sense that some of the things I'm going to say do have a little bit of backing in fact rather than just simply opinion. What I'm going to try to do is to introduce you to the main Caribbean integration project, which is that that's been undertaken by the members of what is called the Caribbean Community, CARICOM. And all good discussions of regional integration start with a map. But this is one, not of the Pacific. CARICOM has 15 members. 12 of them are island economies, and 3 of them, Belize, Guyana, and Suriname, are coastal states. All but 14 of them are independent states, but one of them, Montserrat, is still a dependency of the United Kingdom. There's very significant variation between the members of CARICOM, a bit like as in the Pacific. So if you think in terms of population, it varies between nearly 10 million people in Haiti to just 5,000 people in Montserrat. In terms of land area, similar divergence. The largest is Guyana, that's got nearly 215,000 square kilometres. Montserrat, once again, it's just over 100 square kilometres. And then finally, there are really big differences in levels of economic development. If you think that per capita GDP measures economic development, then you've got to recognise that the Bahamas, with a per capita GDP of over 31,000, is rather more developed than Haiti, with $1,300. And of course, Haiti, we know, is one of the poorest countries in the world. Each of the Caribbean economies, like the Pacific, is very open to international trade. And like the Pacific, they tend to be split between two sorts of traders. There are three countries, Trinidad and Tobago, Suriname, and Guyana, that are resource-rich, and most of their exports are of primary products and mineral and resource-related products. The rest are primarily dependent on services, tourism, like in the Pacific, but also in a number of cases, they've got significant financial service export activities. Like the Pacific, they don't trade much with each other. The only significant amount of trade that does occur between them is when Trinidad and Tobago sells petroleum products to its neighbours. And their main trading partners are North America, Canada, the United States, and the European Union. Okay, that's a very brief introduction to CARICOM. What I want to do now is to give you a bit of an introduction to some of the elements of the regional integration project that CARICOM members have undertaken. And it's important to notice that at the outset that regional integration has long been an essential part of the way in which the people of the Caribbean have seen their future development. And a number of the initiatives long predate independence. In fact, they go back hundreds of years, but possibly the most interesting of the more recent pre-independence initiatives was the attempt by the British to create a federation in the West Indies, basically a political union of 10 of the island colonies. It lasted a very short space of time and fell apart, as far as I can tell, because of the divergent national interests and also the divergent interests of the politicians who led the colonies, a problem that we deal with in the Pacific as well. But after the federation fell apart, the interest in integration did not die. And so it was replaced by a series of increasingly ambitious attempts to garner the benefits of regional integration. And what we see in the Caribbean story is a set of parallel and intersecting paths of economic integration and institutional pooling and cooperation. And so in terms of the economic integration initiatives, what we've seen there is successive deepening. And in fact, I think what's happened is that even before a particular phase in the integration project has been realised, the goalposts have been shifted to set an even harder and more complex integration target for the region. So the initial steps are a free trade association, a very typical kind of free trade agreement that was set up to create a larger protected market for Caribbean manufacturers. That then morphed into a common market, a limited common market, I should say, with the customs union that was created alongside the creation of the Caribbean community itself, which incorporates not only regional integration but also captures a lot of the instruments of pooling and institutional cooperation. And then finally, the next step was to actually set economic union as the target. And that was initiated with the agreement on the Caribbean single market and economy that people came to sign up to in the early 2000s. Functional cooperation and pooling initiatives have long been a part of Caribbean integration. I've given you a large list of acronyms here, but those initiatives have been quite successful, and they've ranged across agricultural research, health, education, standards, policing, customs, and of course sport, with things like the West Indies Cricket Board, probably one of the most important regional institutions they have. There's also been a process of expansion where new members have joined, particularly Haiti and Suriname, interestingly not British-speaking, English-speaking countries, and there's significant talk of the Dominican Republic joining the Caribbean. Another feature of the Caribbean integration, which is long-standing, is that there's been sub-regional integration that's occurred in parallel. So in particular, the Eastern Caribbean Currency Union, that's part of the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States, has been very, very successful since 1981 in running a monetary union. Those members themselves have decided to form an economic union, and I think five of the members of CARICOM that are members of OECS have signed up to the treaty to form that economic union. Okay, I'll skip this slide since I'm running out of time. It just simply tries to replicate what I've already told you, that the economic integration initiatives have become increasingly complex and ambitious. How successful have the economic integration and regional integration efforts been? And here I'm going to draw upon three assessments, two external assessments and one internal assessment. And if I were to summarise what they say, the first assessment, the World Bank says you're not trying hard enough. Pretty typical of the World Bank. The second assessment, which was a group of management consultants, said, oh, you're probably trying to do too much. And the third assessment, which came internally from academics and economists within the Caribbean, was to say, you're probably trying to do the wrong thing. So you can understand the guys running CARICOM are having to deal with some pretty intense criticisms about what they're doing. Just very quickly, what the World Bank said was that the economic integration agenda had stalled, and this was back in 2009, and they listed a whole number of symptoms that they identified as being problems. And a number of the symptoms they identified were not failure to complete even elements of the previous integration initiatives. So the economic union, the CSME, was stumbling because some of the earlier steps hadn't been put in place. But more importantly, some of the critical elements of an economic union, like establishing freedom of movement of goods, factors of production, services and capital, no one had made any real progress in removing the barriers within member countries. And they also then said that the institutional arrangements were not up to the task of giving effect to economic union. The next assessment was actually one commissioned by the CARICOM itself, and it was initially intended to provide recommendations on how to improve the operations of the CARICOM Secretariat, and I think there are some parallels here with what the Pacific Island Forum Secretariat has had to deal with in terms of reviews of its performance. That group of learned people that included jurists from within the Caribbean very quickly concluded that the problem wasn't the Secretariat, it was that in fact the whole CARICOM construct was facing an existential crisis. They said basically the crisis comes because the agenda is excessively ambitious given geographic and economic realities, and the mandates have expanded without any attention being given to implementation and political realities, and there's been a lack of institutional coherence and prioritisation. So the internal assessment, as I said basically the implementation deficit is hardly surprising because there's no benefits in what you're trying to do. And the complexity of what you're trying to do with the economic union leads to the project foundering because of one of the very problems that integration and regionalism were meant to address, which was the problems of state capacity. They also said that the focus on European-style integration, and it's reasonable to say that the CSME was very strongly influenced by thinking about the European integration project, and the Europeans had big inputs into thinking about how the Caribbean would move forward, but also at the time when they adopted it, this was the flavour of the month. The internal critics say the focus on European-style integration has diverted attention away from the strengths of regionalism for small island states, which are basically about functional cooperation and pooling with institutions to deliver regional public goods. They also said that the parallel hemispheric integration that had been going on, and in particular the conclusion of the Economic Partnership Agreement with the European Union, which CARICOM succeeded to achieve along with the Dominican Republic. They said that's actually supplanting rather than reinforcing effective regionalism. I get two more seconds. I'll just quickly run through what I think are lessons of the Pacific again. Look, CARICOM's got some advantages relative to Pacific Island countries. On average, higher levels of economic development. They're much closer to big markets. There's less fragmentation. And there's historically much stronger pan-regional sentiment. It's also useful to recognise, if you cast your mind back to that bank, to that map I showed at the beginning, you can fit the whole of the Caribbean into the territorial waters of Kiribati. So you've got far fewer problems of fragmentation between countries and within countries than you do in the Pacific. But like the Pacific, CARICOM members find themselves between the rock of geography and the hard place of politics in pursuing regional integration. A geographic rock means that regional trade and factor market integration do not act as major drivers of growth. The political hard place means it's hard to get agreement to cede sovereignty to regional institutions to achieve economies of scale and to share costs of statehood. And the geographic rock means that trade and factor market integration is not a good entry point to addressing the barriers to regional cooperation and institutional pooling. That was the essence of the European model. Get business really strongly behind the integration project by liberalising markets first and then move to the institutional setting processes. That will not work in small island states because you don't get the bang for the buck from regional economic integration. It's also not clear that trade and investment agreements with external partners help the regional project. But it's also clear that smaller groupings of similar countries with cultural and historical links may make progress where larger groupings cannot. But I think the biggest lesson from CARICOM experience for the Pacific is it's really important that you match the integration agenda to the political and institutional realities. What is actually feasible? Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Bob, Matt, and Sienna. So we have time for questions, comments, so we'll group them as previously. Yes, thank you.
My name is Terry Henderson. I'm affiliated. A few months ago, I sat in on a speech by the Minister for Finance from Timor-Leste. And among other things, she commented on the very large number of consultants' reports that had been done for that country. And she was certainly not backward in coming forward in what she thought the value of those reports was, which was a lot lower than the pile of reports. But in looking here, there have been a number of studies that are ongoing. I'm neophyte in this. Is there a history of studies about the Pacific that have actually resulted in concrete results on the ground for people?
Yes, thank you.
Hello, I'm Miranda Forsyth at ANU. I'm bringing together the questions of free trade agreements and regional cooperation. Bob, I wonder if you could comment on the experience that CARICOM has had in negotiating the EPA and see whether there's any lessons for the Pacific as it goes forward to negotiate an EPA.
Yes.
If I may, I'd like to ask Saini, if you think there's any chance that the Pacific Plan Review team could recommend that leaders stop having visions? Because it's given us trouble before. that visionary statement has triggered a lot of work that's not going anywhere.
Bob, you mentioned functional cooperation and pooling institutions in CARICOM with the example you gave of standards. I was wondering if instead of pursuing very rigid kinds of economic cooperation and integration and so on, whether it has any loose form of, say, optional participation in, say, some form of regulation that obviously delivers benefits to everybody and obviously saves costs for most of them. Has that been tried there? From memory, I thought there was something in the competition area, but you know, that presumably would get away from this sovereignty issue and allowing the flexibility of opt-in, opt-out, etc. If you've given thought to that.
Thank you. So we have two for Bob, one for Sienna, and one on consultants for anybody.
who's compiled such a study. Bob?
Okay. CARICOM and the EPA, a little bit like the Pacific, the negotiation of the EPA was very contentious within the Caribbean, and they also set up a separate office to negotiate the trade agreement. And unlike most of the other instruments of CARICOM, it was actually given a fair degree of autonomy and independence. It was given very high level status to negotiate the agreement. And it was very successful. As I understand it, the Caribbean CARIFORUM EPA is the only fully completed economic partnership agreement between the EU and ACP states. It covers all of the elements of the agenda. And so at one level you could say that having a really powerful high-level negotiating team can deliver you the agreement. The question is, and this is expressed very strongly by a lot of people in the Caribbean, was the agreement worth getting? And I think it would be fair to say that there's an enormous diversity of opinions on that, probably on balance saying no. And one of the reasons being that although it's helped to deal with the problems that the Caribbean have with dependence on preferences for sugar and bananas and so on, it's helped to sort of give some continued niche for those. The main concern is that, in fact, the institutional arrangements for the EPA now completely supersede the local arrangements for overseeing the regional project. And so people sort of say we've handed away control of the process to this body that's driven out of the process. On the question of optional membership, I can't profess to know in detail, but one of the characteristics of the CARICOM project is, in fact, that not everybody's a member of it. So, for example, the Bahamas, Haiti, and probably Montserrat are not members of the CSME and have said they never will be. So it's possible to have the community and all of its pooling and coordination functions ticking over with those people who want to be party to it, but not necessarily forcing people to take part in the economic integration agenda, which some of them don't think there's any benefit to them. And I also think that some of the regional institutions are optional, because some of them are essentially professional institutions that try and help establish and promulgate professional standards. So compliance with those standards is sometimes an option. It's not necessarily compulsory.
Thank you.
Well,
I think perhaps just
to pick
up on that last point that was made about optional membership, this is something that I think that the review team had picked up in their interim work for the Pacific as well, and he reflected on the point that there certainly were some areas in which it made a lot more sense for some members of this forum grouping to be part of than it did for others, and certainly the history of some attempts at pooling services, and particularly, say, bulk procurement of petroleum as an example, have shown that there were some countries for whom the benefits were clear and others for whom it was of little interest, and so it didn't go forwards because it was held to be a regional initiative, and if not everyone was involved, then it wasn't going ahead. So that may be something that in the future is we looked at for the Pacific, and it's sort of good to learn those lessons. I think just on the question of I certainly can't tell the team to recommend anything in particular to leaders, but I do take the point on visions. I think there's definitely a role in having a vision as a galvanizing force, but then perhaps it leaves us floundering in a way on what to actually do and putting that into place. And I think that one of the messages that has come out of the review thus far has been that perhaps there hasn't been a lot of space for leaders to issue a lot more than visionary statements. There hasn't been a lot of space for them to have the further discussions they need to, in part because the process for taking issues up to leaders has not been as effective as it could have been. In part perhaps because the forum meeting itself has been crowded out by becoming a platform for various international players to come to and try to meet to as well. So I think those will be really big questions that are certainly on the table, and I hope we'll get them asked. So thank you.
Okay, we can squeeze.
I can probably answer the consultancy question. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So as I said at the start of my presentation, there hasn't actually been studies, at least as far as pooled services concerned of the progress with pooled service provision. Obviously, there are a plethora of studies looking at individual initiatives. And sure, I think we can that can be pretty easily criticised when you see consultants being paid big dollars to do those studies. But at the same time, I think that's an inevitable part of regionalism. And I can see a worse situation where studies aren't actually done and regional initiatives are established and then they're of complete value. And I think we've actually seen that in the past in some initiatives. So despite I accept your point, but I think that there is a need for those consultants.
Are you saying that as a consultant?
No, I don't think so.
Couple more questions.
Kathy, I just had a question. You mentioned, I think, provision of tea that central pooled services. You mentioned, I think, vocational education and training is a potential pooled service. Just wondering what your research, looking at the APTC, what sort of 4 or 5 years you had around that?
I'm just wondering if you, Tobias Hack from the World Bank, just wondering, I guess, is both Paul and Matt, what you see as the role for donors in all of this? I mean, there's a very clear collective action problem that you've laid out, right? Firstly, there's a collective action problem. Secondly, there's a sense that the financial returns from regional solutions will not necessarily be great. But we have one of the most aid-heavy regions in the world. Surely there is a role for donors and kind of shocking that collective action problem into a way that makes sense, especially given that donors are paying for a large chunk of service delivery. To some extent, they have a lot to gain from this sort of solve as well. So what can they be doing with it?
Well, no, back there.
Thank you for the presentation. My question is to Barbara. You studied Caribbean and, of course, in the Pacific. Both Caribbean and Pacific, we worked together on the EPA. And at least in the Caribbean, they have actually completed the EPA. In the Pacific, there are two countries. We have completed the Interim Economic Partnership Agreement. The others working on the comprehensive. And, of course, we have Place of Love before us now. There's so many incomplete trade agreements or trade arrangements here in the Pacific. Just, your observation and maybe your advice. In terms of all this, is there one that we should look at first and complete before we proceed with the side case plus or Peter?
Okay, thank you. Responses?
Shall I take the last question first? I think it's a question I'd like to see Wesley actually respond to, because I think he's giving a bit more thought to this. I think there's a real problem with it, because it seems to me that the rest of the world, Australia and New Zealand and the Europeans and others, are falling into the trap that an old friend of mine used to describe as, if your only tool is a hammer, then every problem is a nail. And so what Australia and New Zealand are doing in approaching the Pacific and what the Europeans are doing in approaching the ACP is to say, we want to change the nature of our relationship with you, but we're going to do it through an instrument which is a trade agreement. And to my mind, it's completely the wrong instrument to try and deal with the sorts of things that are useful for the Pacific. Caribbean, maybe not quite so much, but even so, it proved to be pretty much the case there. So my instinct would be to say, don't conclude any of them. Hold on. Hold that up and say, look, this isn't really terribly helpful to us. And the risk is, as is being observed in the Caribbean, if we do sign off to these agreements, we have to implement them. We have to divert an awful lot of really scarce intellectual and managerial resources to implementing something that doesn't really give us much of a benefit. It's missing a point. So I hope Lockton will get away with saying that. But I think it's really worth having it in the back of your mind. You don't. You maybe should not be forced to do these if you don't think they're really actually dealing with the real issues that are useful for the Caribbean to be helped, for the Pacific to be helped in.
I mean, I must just quickly that our toolbox does have more than one tool. It's not just a hammer. If you look at the spread of things that we do across the Pacific, I mean, if anything, it's a bewildering toolbox of all sorts of things going on. So there's no way that we put all of our eggs into this basket. I can confirm that by moving into this policy tutor. So I propose a policy, but one with many different things going on. I do take your point about capacity, that is critical, capacity to negotiate, which we provide problems assistance, or we have to propose a cost front, but capacity to implement, that is critical. We don't want to divert limited capacities into this. I think judgment has to make a little bit more sure.
Yes. And as a case of plus negotiator for Australia, I can most definitely say that the Forum Island countries have some very clear objectives and offensive interests in the negotiation of these agreements, including in relation to things that you could call trade matters. So there's a question there of asking Forum Island countries what they think their objectives are and to inquire into them and to see how they would envisage them being realised through an agreement.
So briefly on vocational education, it's not something that I've looked at closely yet. It was included in the Pacific Plan as an area of interest. I think the APTC has great potential, although I'd agree with Richard, who spoke earlier about, I think to maximise its potential, it really needs to result in Pacific Islanders actually having access to these great things in our labour markets. And I don't think that's something that we've seen yet. In response to Tobias's trick question about the role for donors, I don't think there are any really easy answers in this area. I mean, it's an area that's been extensively studied, and not just in relation to regionalism, but in terms of development assistance. There are these moral hazard problems that arise almost inevitably when aid is given. It's not a reason to stop giving aid, but it does complicate the process. The only thing I would say is that I think donors, the best they can do is, implement the commitments that they've made under the Paris Declaration, Cairns Compact, and agreements such as those.
Can I just offer a quick response to the advice as well? One of the challenges, it seems to me, with the regional pooling of institutions approach is that the intention is to try and get stronger institutions that can step over the capacity and scale problems that confront the members of a particular regional grouping. The challenge to my mind is that if you had your druthers, who would you think about actually trying to be the provider of that pooled service? And it may well be someone who's actually got more capabilities than exists within the region. And that, I think, is the challenge for donors, that ideally it might make more sense for the Pacific to think in terms of pooling with Australia and New Zealand, or maybe somewhat less difficult to deal with than Australia and New Zealand. But it's hard to present that solution given all of the very appropriate sensitivities about sovereignty and so on. So often I think channeling through regional institutions is a way that donors and interested partners like Australia and New Zealand have to try and solve that problem, because it's just politically impossible to deal with it the most direct way.
Okay, let's thank our three presenters.